Well, welcome to CORE. We are so glad you guys are here with us this morning. You can go ahead, have a seat really quickly. We have officially reached the Christmas season. And I don't know if you are feeling the weight and the hustle of that yet, but I know within my own house we are. And we are more than excited to be launching this brand new series this morning that we are calling The Day After Christmas. But before we launch fully into that series, I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't stop and celebrate where we've been. You see, many of you know that throughout the month of November, we've been coming through Generosity Month, and we've had sort of this stance, this declaration over the course of the last couple of years that we wanted to be a church that led the way with irrational generosity. And one of the central components of that is that every single November, we've gotten into the habit of doing something that we call Global Impact Day. And maybe some of y'all were here a couple weeks ago, others of you weren't. But essentially, this one day is an opportunity where we don't do service in this room, but we slap on hairnets and there are stations all throughout here. And this year, we had a goal of packing 33,000 meals for the hungry, homeless, and needy right here in our state. And yet what may be more exciting than that is this, is that so many of y'all signed up, you showed up, you went to town on putting a hairnet on and overcame those insecurities, and we reached this year almost 34,000 meals in one day. Isn't that incredible? And the reason why we do Global Impact Day is really twofold. Number one, because we want it to be a catalyst in each one of our individual lives. That as we head towards the holiday season, we believe that every single one of us in this room are going to intersect with other people. And opportunities are going to arise in which we have an opportunity to be generous in their circumstances and their lives. And what would it look like for us to stand in that gap? But secondly, we do this because we want to put our money where our mouth is. And if we want to be individuals who are willing to lead the way with irrational generosity, then we organizationally need to go first. And what you may not know is that Global Impact Day isn't just an opportunity for you to sign up and do service work. That every single one of those 34,000 meals that we packed, we as an organization bought every single one of those meals. In fact, we organizationally invested over $10,000 in this one day to help feed hungry, homeless people right here in our world. And the only reason why we're able to do that is because you guys lead the way with irrational generosity. It's because of the way you guys sacrifice and give week in and week out to see a mission not happen within these four walls, but ultimately happen within our world. And so this morning, before we dove into the Christmas season, I wanted to stop and just simply say thank you. That your generosity of time and finances does not go unnoticed, not just by me and our staff, but by a world that is being changed in the name of Jesus because of what you're doing. But as we push all of that to the back burner and now we launch into our Christmas season over the course of the next couple of weeks, we're going to be diving into this series that really underlines and underscores why this season is so unique and so special to so many of us. You see, if you're anything like me, you look back on your childhood and you can see all of these traditions and memories around the holiday season that make your Christmas from your past or even into your present so memorable and so special. And yet also, if you're anything like me, maybe you can relate to this, as you begin to share those stories with other people about your Christmas traditions from your past, they're only special to you because you begin to tell the stories and everybody else is like, wait, what's the ending? I don't get why that was so meaningful and so special. Like for us, growing up, most of our Christmas traditions revolved around Christmas Eve night. We had a tradition of every single year as a family, we would go to Christmas Eve services. And yet before Christmas Eve and us being a family of six and mom having four kids trying to get them ready for Christmas Eve service and buying all the gifts and knowing what was to come that night and wrapping the gifts and putting them together and finding the necessary batteries and getting them under the Christmas tree and all that, very early on in my life, I can remember we deemed Christmas Eve night a no cooking night. And so we would just head out as a family and we would eat out. And yet one year, as we went to eat out at our normal spot, we found that that Christmas Eve, it was not open. And so we went searching throughout Ontario, like, okay, where else can we go? Where can we find a place? And it was like that Christmas Eve, everybody made the determination, we're either closing on Christmas Eve or we're closing early on Christmas Eve. And we could only find one restaurant that was open. The Golden Arches, McDonald's. And so there we were, family of six, before Christmas Eve service, and the holiest meal we could come up with was driving through the drive-thru at McDonald's. And yet there was this nostalgic place in my family for just creating traditions, even if they were dumb traditions. Sorry, moms, in this service. And so what we did, I can remember this as a child, we made it a tradition that from that year forward, we went through the drive-thru at McDonald's before we went to the Christmas Eve services. And that became a tradition within the Carver household for us to go to McDonald's as our Christmas Eve dinner. But then after Christmas Eve services, we always did the exact same thing. After Christmas Eve services, it was always our sibling gift exchange. And so we'd sit down around the tree after we got home, and we had gone out and we had bought gifts for all of our siblings, and we'd exchange them to start our Christmas season in the spirit of giving rather than receiving. And yet, one thing you have to know about my family is this: no celebration is complete unless it entails food. And so with that, our after Christmas Eve service festivities always had to have dessert. And the dessert that we had at the center of our Christmas Eve festivities was not pie, was not some sort of Christmas cookie. It was Christmas ice cream. And the best way that I can describe this, if you've never seen it before, is it's like a Christmas cutout cookie, except in ice cream form. It came in a box, and you put it in your freezer, and then each one was individually wrapped in a cellophane wrapper. And so we'd get home, and before we did our sibling gift exchange, you'd get the box out of the freezer, and you'd literally just crack open the cellophane wrapper, and you'd just plop it out on your plate, like literally like that. You'd just throw it down on your plate. And it'd come out in this shape that was shaped as some sort of Christmas figure. For example, and the reason I say Christmas cookie cutout, like to paint a picture in your mind, is because you'd flop it onto your plate, and it was vanilla ice cream, and yet it was shaped like Santa Claus, and then the ice cream was literally colored or dyed in all the colors to make it look like Santa Claus. So it was dyed red, it was dyed black, it had the gold buttons on it, all that good stuff, and we'd flop that out onto our Christmas design plates, and that was our dessert that we had every single Christmas Eve. And then we transformed to Christmas Day, and I can still remember every year we had the exact same amount of gifts. Every one of us kids got 10 gifts each to open on Christmas Day, and we'd go around the circle, and one by one we'd open, and sometimes it'd be socks was one of your gifts, and then sometimes it'd be something that was a little bit better than socks. As an adult, you're like, yeah, socks is at the top of the list. I need some of those for the holy ones I got. And yet every single one of us in the room, I would venture to guess, can look back on our lives, our childhood, and we can remember those traditions that we held that made Christmas special. And maybe some of them we've implemented into our family, or we've come up with brand new ones that carry us into Christmas Day, and that sometimes, dare I say, even happen after Christmas Day is over. Like, I'd venture to guess that there are some of us in the room that have a Christmas tradition that on the day after Christmas, we gather all the women in the family and the sisters and the moms and the aunts and the cousins and grandma, and we all gather together, and the day after we just got done opening all of our presents, we recognize that the day after Christmas is a great day to get things on sale, and so we all collectively go out on a shopping trip, and that is our tradition on the day after Christmas. Or maybe, Dad, your day after Christmas tradition is all those boxes on Christmas Eve night from Amazon that you broke down and made a nice stack of in the garage. You now, the day after Christmas, go back out to the garage, get the boxes, and start to put them back together for all the things that you've been told have to go back to the store now. Or maybe some of y'all, you're like, I'm good with celebrating Christmas through New Year's Day, but once New Year's hits, it's like the Christmas season is over, and so New Year's within your family has become the day in which you have a party and tearing down all the exterior lights, and the Christmas tree finally comes down. But for me, what I have to admit is this, and no Scrooges come out of your mouth in this moment. What I have to admit is that for me, the day after Christmas is a day in which it feels like I'm just about ready for things to go back to normal. Like in all the hustle and all the bustle and all the chaos of getting things ready for the family and the kids for Christmas Day and everything that goes into that, on top of everything that goes into what happens around here for Christmas Eve services and creating an engaging service and having almost 500 people come through the door on one night and making that just an incredible night, by the time our family gets to the day after Christmas, it's like we're exhausted from all of this Christmas that's around us. And if it didn't take any work, it was just like snap your fingers and it would happen, my preference would be on the day after Christmas. Like, I'm totally fine. Let's gather up all the things that have gone underneath the Christmas tree. Let's get them in the kids' drawers. Let's put the toys in the toy boxes. And let's just start taking down the Christmas tree, because Christmas is officially in the rearview mirror. And I am just so ready for things to be normal again. And ironically, 2,000 years ago, in the aftermath of the very first Christmas, the entire world was ready for things to go back to normal again. Because at around the time of that very first Christmas, in an attempt to systemize and modernize the tax system of the entire world, Caesar Augustus got this bright idea that he was going to implement this. That in Luke chapter 2, starting in verse 1, we find what was happening in the entire world at the time of the very first Christmas. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. That in order for the Roman government to figure out who was still alive and how much money everybody was making and how much taxes everybody should be paying, Caesar Augustus made this determination. I want everybody to go back to the town of their birth, and I want them to submit a report of all of these different things to tell us that they're still alive and how much they're making, for us to determine the fair amount of taxes that we should be collecting so that we don't get shorted as a Roman government. And can you imagine 2,000 years ago how difficult it would have been to collect information for the census? Like, we look back to the census just a couple years ago, and what you'd see is this. We don't have accurate information. We're kind of close on this, and that's with modern technology, y'all. There was no technology, no computer submission, no help coming from any outside sources. You literally traveled through the perils. You picked up your life, traveled back to your hometown, and do you know what met you when you got back to your hometown? A line that the Taco Bell drive-thru ain't got nothing on. Some of y'all know what I'm talking about, right? Like, we have been standing here for the last hour. Can I just get out of line now? Taco Bell drive-thru ain't got nothing on what was taking place in everybody's hometown a couple thousand years ago. And because of that, 2,000 years ago, everybody was just ready to get back to normal. And the reality is 2,000 years ago, y'all, there was no such thing as Christmas. 2,000 years ago, there was really just chaos. This census was expensive and inconvenient and even dangerous to so many families to travel the routes that they had to travel to get back to their hometown. And it was like Caesar Augustus was making this proclamation to all the bandits and all the robbers. Hey, everybody's going to be on the roads at the exact same time. If you want to rob somebody and get rich, now's the time to do it. You can imagine what these families were experiencing at knowing what lied out in front of them. And in the aftermath of all of this, they just wanted things to go back to normal. At no time in history had there ever been a point in which the entire world was ready for normal more than then. And yet, unbeknownst to them, things would never be normal again. Because at the very same time as a census was taking place for the entire world to report back to their hometown, in conjunction with that, something absolutely incredible, dare I say someone absolutely incredible, was being birthed into the world. This very thing was happening at that exact same time. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling. The God of the universe put on skin and bones and came to live among us and came to make his home here on earth, to walk in our shoes, to rub shoulders with us, to experience the hurt and the heartache and the messes that come along with living life here on that earth. And essentially what was taking place on this one night in the middle of the chaos 2,000 years ago was right smack dab in the middle of all of that chaos, a king was being secreted into the world. And let's just be clear about something. Because we get all of these warm and fuzzies as we look at what Christmas really means, and maybe on Christmas Eve night, the tradition within our household of sitting down and reading the Christmas story, and there's this cute little baby being swaddled in cloth. This wasn't just a religious figure that was being born. This wasn't some incredibly brilliant teacher or a crafted Jewish rabbi. No, it was so much more than that. This was a king being secreted into the world that would reverse the order of literally everything. A king who would lay down his life for his subjects instead of demanding that his subjects lay down their lives for him. A king who would somehow reverse the socioeconomic order in the world and begin to give value and care to the least of these. A king who would demand of his subjects that they be willing to lay down their pride in order to love their enemies. A king who was willing to say, anybody can love their friends. What if you were different enough to love those who hate you? An upside-down kingdom was being brought on the back of this king who was secreted into the world in the midst of the chaos 2,000 years ago. And yet here we are, fast forward 2,000 years later. And if you're anything like me, some of the sheen and the significance of that night 2,000 years ago has washed off. Because if you're anything like me, as you travel through your own chaotic Christmas season, your own less than optimum circumstances, it becomes ridiculously easy to reduce a story of a king being secreted into this world to that baby being far less than he was ever meant to be. That if you're anything like me, it's easy to reduce this baby named Jesus into simply a get-out-of-jail-free card. And I'll follow my own way, my own choices, my own path until I back myself into a corner and things aren't going the way I want. And then I've got this trump card that I haven't been following, not really adhering to, but I'll just hold that in my back pocket to pull out if things ever get really bad in following my own way. Or maybe we reduce Jesus to just a conscience reliever. That we've heard that Jesus is just all grace all the time, and so when things get bad enough and I make enough mistakes, I don't have to worry about the mistakes or the direction that I'm going because I've got this conscience reliever that's just all grace all the time. Or maybe Jesus has been reduced to just a backup plan. And I'm not sure I can really trust him to take control of my life and lead me in the direction that I want to go with enough zeros on the end of my paycheck that I want. But I think he's kind of a cool dude, kind of good, and so I'll keep that as my backup plan just in case my first plan doesn't work out in my life or in my Christmas. And time again, we've reduced Jesus in our lives and in our Christmas season and even in the way we look at the Christmas story to far less than he was ever meant to be. We reduce Jesus to a place in which the benefits for our lives and our eternity shrink along with the way in which we've shrunk him. And yet 2,000 years ago, a man and a woman, a mother and a father, proclaimed that who Jesus was could never be reduced in their mind. Because when an angel came to Mary and Joseph and described who this baby would become, what they knew from that day forward is that this baby could never be reduced to less than that this baby was far more than a get-out-of-jail-free card or a backup plan or a conscience reliever. That sure, at times in our lives, he can be any of those things, but for us to simply reduce him to that and that alone was missing something so magnificent, something so grand, something so life-changing in our own lives and so world-changing for the world around us that we dare not miss it from the day after Christmas. You see, this is how the angel described who this baby was, now, and for forever to to Mary and Joseph. In Luke chapter 1, we find this coming to fruition on this night. And the story goes like this. "Don't be afraid, Mary," the angel told her, "for you have found favor with God. You will conceive and give birth to a son, and you will name him Jesus. He will be very great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God," and this is so good, y'all. This is where everything changes. This is where it's no longer just the birth of a baby, no longer just the birth of a religious figure or a Jewish rabbi or an incredible teacher. "The Lord will give him the throne of his ancestor David, and he will reign over Israel." If you have a pen, this is what you should underline: forever. His kingdom will never end. You see, it was made abundantly clear on that night that Jesus was being born into this world a king. And yet the angel did not stop there. Because this baby wasn't just being born into this world, secreted into this world as a king for one period of time, to reign as king for his 33 some odd years that he would live on this earth. No, it went one step further and it said, no, he isn't just a king now, he is still king forever. That is who Jesus is, was, and always will be. He was born into this world a king, and his kingdom will never end. And oftentimes, as we get into the habit of reading this story, we skim right past that part. But if we were to stop and center in at that one moment in time in which who Jesus was adequately defined for all of eternity, as Christ followers, it would demand of us that we wrestle with, grapple with a question on a daily basis that would change our lives. Because as Christ followers, every single morning in light of this Christmas, and the day after and every day since, and what we know Jesus is and will always be, the question that we should be asking every time our legs swing over the side of our bed and hit the floor every single morning is this: is Jesus my king? Is he the one that I revere? Is he the one that I follow? Or hang on, y'all. In my Christmas season, have the presents become king? Has the hustle become king? Have the parties become king? Has my own way become king? Is Jesus really my king? Or have I simply reduced him to less than he was ever meant to be? Have I forced him into this box of what I need in my life right now, or what I need during this particular Christmas season and the circumstances that I've walked through? And you see, what may be most astonishing about this king that was secreted into the world was this, is that 2,000 years ago, this king that was secreted into the world is a king that allows us to choose whether we will make him king or not. A king who invites us to follow him with our life and yet never demands. A king who invites us to follow him with our actions and yet never intrudes. A king who every single day of our life allows us to make our own choice of whether or not we will follow him and place him in a place of our lives in which he is our king now and forevermore. He would never make us follow him. And yet, when I choose not to follow the king, I also choose not to be a part of his kingdom on this earth. I choose not to be a part of this upside down kingdom that changed everything. And yet when we give our lives to it, what we undoubtedly see is that when we follow the kingship of the king, that part of our world, that part of the world becomes a better and safer place because of our willingness to give our hearts to that king who changed everything. An upside down kingdom that changes it all. And when we opt out of submitting to that kingship and being a part of that kingdom here on earth, what ultimately happens is this. Whether we admit it or not, when I opt out, I always miss out. When we opt out, y'all, this is ultimately what happens in our lives. Faith is reduced to doctrine. Faith is reduced to religion. Sure, we become Christians by the modern sense of the word. Maybe not by the original sense of the word. Y'all okay? You see, when we opt out, ultimately what happens is that heaven and earth never overlap in our lives and in our stories. We miss this kingdom come that changed everything 2,000 years ago, but still has the ability to change everything now. In our lives, in our families, in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces, in our city, and in our world. We miss out on all of that change that God wants to bring in and through us when we refuse to participate in his kingdom and submit to his kingship. So on that first Christmas, in the midst of all the chaos, a king was secreted into the world. And here's what's crazy, y'all. It was a plan that was perfectly executed. This king would have remained a secret if it had not been for a few confused magi that stumble onto the pages of history looking for this king, looking for this Messiah, looking for this one who would change it all and brought to the forefront of the story, the exposure of this king in the unlikeliest of ways to the unlikeliest of people. If not for these three magi, Mary and Joseph's secret king would have remained a secret probably for the next 30 years. And yet what ultimately happens in the days and the weeks and the months and the years after Jesus' birth ultimately write a new story in your life and in my life, because it exposes something incredible in that first interaction between the Magi and the current king in the world. Here's how the story goes. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. Now, what you may not know about King Herod is this, to give you a little bit of context. King Herod had this nickname. He was actually nicknamed Herod the Great. And Herod the Great was great. He was an absolutely incredible ruler. He was brilliant. Herod the Great was the one who actually rebuilt the entire temple in the city of Jerusalem. He was a brilliant architect, and yet on top of that, he was a military strategist at his finest. Herod was an incredible general. And because of all of Herod's greatness, what we know is that Herod was leaving behind this incredible legacy. And yet because of this legacy that Herod had birthed around himself and his greatness, Herod was absolutely ruthless about ensuring that that legacy continued. And a couple thousand years ago, if you can picture with me, the only way in which your legacy continues on as a king is for your legacy to be passed down through kingship to your offspring, to your kids. And so Herod was ruthless about the fact, if I want my incredible legacy to live on, it means that my kids have to become king. And from there, their kids, my grandkids, have to become king. And my great-grandkids and my great-great-grandkids. And Herod was absolutely ruthless about ensuring that his legacy and his greatness would live on by his kids taking over the throne. And yet here are these three dudes who come and put a crimp into that plan. About that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem. And for just 20 seconds here, I'm going to burst your Christmas song bubble. I apologize. But what we know about these three dudes is that they weren't actually king. When it refers to them as magi or wise men, essentially what we could imagine is that these three guys were like court advisors. They were incredibly brilliant. They studied the stars. They knew about the religious systems around the kingdom, and they reported those things back to the court systems, to the king above them. And so they weren't three kings, and what we also know is that these guys really weren't even following the star. And you're like, oh, there goes we three kings. Ben, how could you say that? That is like biblical. We know that they weren't actually following the star, because if they were, they wouldn't have ended up in Jerusalem. The star was not over Jerusalem. And yet here come these three dudes. They roll up in Jerusalem and they ask this question that changes it all. Where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him. And as soon as King Herod the Great hears this one word, king, come out of these three dudes' mouths, all of a sudden, all of the emergency systems go off in his mind. And we see the response go like this. King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. And if you're anything like me, you're like, whoa, 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 Ben. We've talked many times about how long these Jewish people have waited for a Messiah. And so at the sniff of this could possibly be a Messiah, why was everybody disturbed? I don't get it. Because these people had been around the ancient world long enough to know that any time a second king came on to the scene, what would eventually happen? There would be kingdom turmoil. There would be an uprising that would happen. There would be economic ripple effects that would happen. Their lives were not going to be normal if this was a second king coming onto the pages of history. And everybody was concerned about what their futures look like and what life from here would look like within their own life and their own little bubble. And on top of that, King Herod was deeply disturbed for every reason that we talked about earlier, because he knew if there was another king that was born, it was a threat to his legacy. It was a threat to his kingship being passed on down his lineage to his offspring and for his greatness to rule for forever. And so King Herod, he was threatened by all of this. And in his disturbed state, Herod asked this question and uses this word. This is so good, y'all. This word that absolutely changes the game. That he decides, I have to do something now to stomp this out. This is where his ruthlessness comes in. And we know what happens in the aftermath, right? He sends his army out to kill every baby that's 2 years old or younger, every baby boy within the entire kingdom. And yet in his ruthlessness, his first step is this. I have to find out where this baby is. And yet in the midst of his rage and his anger, he throws out this word that signifies who this Jesus really is. King Herod called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of the religious law, and he asked this question. Where is the Messiah to be born? Where is the Messiah being born? And in this one Greek word that we see translated into Messiah, essentially, the king is throwing out a Greek word in this moment that literally means God's final king, God's anointed one. This word that King Herod uses is this Greek word that is literally the word Christos. Sound like something else? Christ. And yet oftentimes, if you're anything like me, he uses this word that really defines who Jesus is. And yet oftentimes when we see the word Christ, it's like it automatically goes with Jesus. Jesus Christ. Christ Jesus our Lord. And we've reduced the word Christ to Jesus' last name. It's like Carver and Christ, you know, kind of are the same thing. It's just the last name of who Jesus is. That's what we've reduced it to. And yet what we miss is that that's not it at all. And the reason that we've missed it along the way
is that oftentimes what we've allowed to happen when it comes to this Greek word Christos is this. We've allowed the person to define the term instead of allowing the term to define the person. And here's why it's so important to flip that script. Because Christ is not Jesus' last name. Christ is Jesus' title. Here's what that means. Is that every time we hear, we say, we see Jesus Christ, what is actually being confirmed is Jesus, God's anointed one. Jesus, King. King Jesus. This is who he was in his fullness, then and now. A king who was appointed to establish a kingdom that was not of this world, but was in this world. A kingdom not of this world, but for this world. A kingdom that could best be classified as an other's first kingdom. And Herod suspected it, and he was threatened by it. Because Herod knew something that oftentimes in the craziness of our own Christmases, we miss. And it's that when a king is born, people must choose. When a king is born, people must choose. Will I follow? Will I submit? Is that king worth following? Where will my allegiance fall? And more importantly, when there's the option of multiple kings, the choice becomes more apparent. And y'all, while our choice may not be King Herod or King Jesus, we have plenty of kings to give our allegiance to. What will we choose? Several decades ago, the power of that truth and that reality was discovered by an atheist. An atheist who became one of the greatest authors of all time. A guy by the name of C.S. Lewis. And in one of C.S. Lewis' books, he writes this very short passage at the very end that I feel remiss if I didn't tie into this morning. Because in this one short passage by C.S. Lewis, he begins to underline and underscore the true meaning of the Christmas season and what it demands of me and what it demands of you. A passage so full of truth that it changes the way we do our lives. It changes the way we act and react. That it defines what the day after Christmas, until now, demands of every single one of us when a king was secreted into this world. You see, C.S. Lewis writes this. I wonder whether people who ask God to interfere openly and directly in our world quite realize what it will be like when he does. That so often, if you're anything like me, my prayer life can be easily diminished to all of the hurt and the brokenness we see in our world. And it's like, God, fix this. Like we look at God as if he has that magic spray, and it's just like, there's something not right here and not right there in my life or in my world. God, can you just hit that? And fix this, and fix some of that. And then he points it towards us. No, not me. I don't need any of that spray on me and my life and where I am and who I'm choosing to follow. Do the people who actually ask God to interfere in our world know what it's like when he actually steps in for the last time? When that happens, it is the end of the world. And this is so cool. Paints this picture in our minds. When the author walks on stage, the play is over. God's going to invade, all right. There will come a time when God will once and for all invade the messes and the brokenness of our world and make it right again. God is going to invade, all right. But what is the good of saying you are on his side then. In the moment when you see the whole natural universe melting away like a dream, and something else, something that never entered your head to conceive, comes crashing in, something so beautiful to some of us and so terrible to others. This reality that when he comes and invades the masses of our world one last time, that none of us will have any choice left. And then he says something so profound, something that brings us back into the Christmas story and connects the dots from 2,000 years ago until now and every single one of our lives. He uses these three words, "for this time." It's as if he's making mention of the reality that God has invaded our earth once. He's put on flesh and bone one other time, that he's come to this earth. And when he came the very first time, his purpose was this: to make right what we had broken, to put back together a fissured relationship that we couldn't put back together ourselves, to bring this incredible amount of grace with him so that we could spend eternity with him. But this time when he comes again, it will be God without disguise. Not this seemingly meek and mild human being who seemed to be held at the reins of the world around him and the government systems around him. No, this will be God without disguise. Something so overwhelming that it will strike either irresistible love or irresistible terror into every creature. At that point, it'll be too late then to choose your side. For there's no use in saying you choose to lie down when it's become impossible to stand. That will not be the time for choosing. It'll be the time when we discover which side we really have chosen. It'll be the time when our choice has been revealed, whether we realized it before or not. And then, in pulling back into the Christmas story and what the day after Christmas means in every single one of our lives, right here, right now, C.S. Lewis makes it so real and so relevant, so important for every single one of our lives and our futures. He writes this: now, today, in this moment, it is our chance to choose. Now, in this moment, today, is our chance to choose. Our time to answer the question with our lives and our thoughts and our beliefs and the way in which we follow. And then he says, "I got to go back one last time." And he pulls into the forefront something that Peter wrote, a follower of Jesus a couple thousand years ago. When he makes reference to this reality that Jesus is holding back, he's waiting because of his great love for us to give us time to choose. God is holding back to give us that chance. But don't miss the urgency with your life, with your family, with the example that you set, with the side that you choose. Because that choice, it will not last forever. We must take it or leave it. You see, I don't know about you, but when I read through that excerpt, it's emotional for me. Because it's not ridiculously difficult for me to look back at my past and my life and to see the many moments in which I have chosen a way that is contrary to the King. And yet a God of love stands there and continues to ask, "Today, what will your choice be? I love you enough to not invade, I simply invite you.
you to follow me, to be a part of my kingdom on this earth, an upside down kingdom that has the ability to change everything. But when a king comes, people must choose. I must choose. Is Jesus really my king? This Christmas, do I act like, react like, believe like, follow like he is worthy of my song? He is worthy of my praise. He is worthy of my time. He is worthy of what I have. Is that what our Christmas is defined by? Or have we, in our time, in our hustle, in our chaos, whether we know it or not, chosen another king? Because when we choose to submit to his kingship, he is a king that, while contrary to the culture around us, changes everything for the better. But only when we become people who are courageous enough to submit to his kingship and declare him worthy of all we are. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you for being a God who 2,000 years ago invaded our world to make right what was broken, to extend grace where our own efforts couldn't span the gap, to show your great love by putting on flesh and blood. You came, heaven and earth collided. Not for a day, not for 33 years, for forever. And yet, God, when I look at my own life and my own story, what I see time and time again is that I've chosen my own way. I've chosen my own kings. There have been moments of my life in which I've determined I'm just going to power up and I can handle this myself. And I know what's best for me. And yet, God, this Christmas, I'm tired of following all my own kings that lead me down a path I was never meant to go, a path that doesn't really fix anything, that over time it just makes things worse. So, God, this Christmas, may we be courageous enough to first ask the question, is Jesus my king? And then with our lives, our action, our words, to answer that question emphatically, yes, he's my king. And I'll live as if he's worthy of it all. Thank you for who you are, for your great love in our lives, and for loving us enough to allow us to choose. It's in your name that we